This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories, which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com. And also by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Here comes the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland, the show that takes its name from Karl Marx's description of the subversive forces of revolution that continue working underground even when overt political conditions seem darkest. The Old Mole digs deeper into the meanings of our political, social, and cultural world. Today, Bill Resnick talks with Ben Cole and Linda Farthing, authors of Impasse in Bolivia, Neoliberal Hegemony and Popular Resistance. First with Ben Cole about the Morales government, and later in the show with Linda Farthing about the politics of growing coca. In between, I'll have a well-read read on war resistance in the military, and before we go, I'll be talking with movie mole Jan Hocken about the movie she's making, a documentary about drag club Darcel 15, Queens of Heart, Community Therapists in Drag, which will be shown tomorrow night at the Hollywood Theater. My name is Fran Michelle, and our engineer today is Tammy Dean. First up, Bill Resnick talks with Ben Cole on Bolivia Today, the new Morales government, how this indigenous former head of the Coca Growers Union became president in a landslide, what his coalition is doing, and whether there's room for challenging neoliberalism and creating real development in Bolivia.
Hi, folks. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole on KABU. I'll be talking to Ben Cole, author with Linda Farthing, of Impasse in Bolivia, Neoliberal Hegemony and Popular Resistance. We'll be talking about the remarkable changes in Latin American politics, Bolivia as the case study. Ben Cole, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Ben Cole, Evo Morales joined Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro on George Bush's axis of evil in Latin America, of course, with many other co-conspirators. Tell us how an indigenous leader, former head of the Coca Growers Union, he campaigned on a program of stopping the eradication of cocoa and nationalization of the gas industry. How did he become president of Bolivia? And now he's making good on his campaign promises. How did it happen?
Okay, well, first, Evo identifies himself along with Chavez as part of, and Lula as part of the axis of, and Fidel as part of the axis of good.
Mm-hmm.
Refer to your question: how did he become president? He had a long. You're looking at someone who, for 20 years, has been involved in resistance to neoliberal policies, who's been involved in resistance to the U.S. low-intensity war against peasants in Bolivia. And it was through his organization of the coca producers that he first became elected as a deputy in 1997 to the lower house of Congress in Bolivia, and then ran for president in 2002, where he came in second by 1.5%, and in December of 2005, when he won the first majority in a Bolivian election. And here we need to understand that Bolivia, unlike the United States, has six or eight or 11 parties posting candidates at any one time. So the fact that he was able to win 54% of the vote is truly an astounding feat and truly shows the level of support that he has among Bolivia's largely indigenous population.
Yeah, it's also, though, the result of, right, this extraordinary uprising and organization of what once was a quite fractured, we call it an indigenous movement, but it was basically groups that spoke different languages and often made war on one another until fairly recently. I mean, it was a tremendous uprising and organization of the poor.
It was.
Is that right?
Yeah, to a certain degree. These groups hadn't necessarily made war against each other. There are two major indigenous...
Or were really in deep conflict, I'm sorry.
They were, in Bolivia, the lowland and valley Quechua, the highland Aymara, where there has been some tension, but there's also a lot of people who claimed mixed heritage. But what Abel was able to do was he was able to bring together this indigenous group, but it wasn't solely, his support didn't only come from indigenous people, it also came from the urban poor, which represent probably one of the largest and most active social movements in Bolivia today. In 2003 and 2005, half a million people mobilized in the city of El Alto, which is a poor city adjoining the capital of La Paz, and forced governments who were not respecting the wishes of the people to retire.
You know, I guess that brings us then to what neoliberalism has done to Bolivia. That is, and the mobilization of the poor against it. Tell us that story.
Beginning in 1985, with the debt crisis, much of America suffered a debt crisis in the mid-1980s as a result of the first oil crisis and the circulating of the petrodollars through the economy, banks looking for homes for the money, lending them to countries throughout the world. A lot of that money ended up in Latin America. They borrowed money, primarily corrupt governments, making investments that didn't pay off, siphoning the money off, bringing to a debt crisis in the 1980s where the World Bank comes in and brings about a series of what they call structural adjustment programs that reduce government spending and really constrict the ability of governments to make economic policy. For the last 20 years, then, these policies have been reshaping and reforming economics and politics throughout Latin America. Evo was part of a movement that has resisted these neoliberal policies since 1985.
And what did the neoliberal policies do particularly to Bolivia in that period?
Okay.
I mean, why was Evo resisting and why was there so much, why the mobilization from below?
Okay. Well, the biggest impact in 1985 began with the shutting down of the state mines that had been the control under the control of a very militant miners' union, which was one of the strongest organized forces in labor forces movements in Latin America. When that movement was decimated in 1985, even though there were a series of protests, the mining union by itself was not able to resist these series of changes. The resistance then transferred from the miners' union over a period of years into other social movements, most important being the coca growers. As the leader of this coca growers movement, we need to remember this is not an overnight sensation. He's an overnight sensation who worked for 20 years to get to where he is. As a very young man, in his mid-20s, Abel became one of the key leaders of the coca producers and essentially was resisting the U.S. drug policy, the U.S. low-intensity war against peasants in the Chapari. And through that movement, first organized at the local level or the regional level of the tropics of Cochabamba, where the coca producers had been organized, to a national level. And what was happened is that even after these 20 years of neoliberal policies, there were a series of promises that were made that growth would go to 10% a year, which is the current type of economic growth we see in China, that hundreds of thousands of new jobs would be made. None of these promises came through with the neoliberal economic program. Instead, poverty has persisted. Still today, you have about over a third of the Bolivian population that lives on less than $2 a day. And what Evo has done is mobilized those populations and said, look, we can't provide an alternative. And we need to begin to build that alternative by nationalizing Bolivian resources.
Mm-hmm. And not only let's talk about the alternative, but another side of the neoliberalism, and I think all over Latin America, is that they insisted on cutting government public expenditures, of course, to pay the debts. That is, it went right into the banks in New York and Zurich and other places. But they were cutting public expenditures, which meant that there was a lot less opportunity for education, child care, public health, or medical care, right? Everything was cut for people. Standards of living, not only did wages not go up or jobs, but in fact, the kind of life-giving public services deteriorated.
Yeah, no, that's very true, and that's one of the things that we see in Bolivia. But Bolivia, even at the same time that the central government was cutting education, child care, and health care expenses, international institutions, UNICEF, the WHO, a whole series of transnational aid organizations assumed these social expenditures and assumed many of the functions of the central state. So that even paradoxically, at the same time that we see the state reducing its public expenditures, we do see some of the indicators in terms of things like infant mortality actually improving because of key investments made by UNICEF.
That's particularly a Bolivian story, then, I guess.
That's a particularly Bolivian story.
Right. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Ben Cole, who, along with Linda Farthing, wrote a very recent book, and very relevant and wonderful book, Impasse in Bolivia, Neoliberal Hegemony and Popular Resistance. We've been talking about the Evo Morales' election as president, and an unprecedentedly victory, actually, a huge percentage of the vote for Bolivia, based in the mobilization of the indigenous and the urban poor, and probably a lot of middle-class people in some way as well. We also were talking about why that occurred. Partly, of course, it's the neoliberalism. One other thing, though, that Ben Cole, that seems to me so remarkable is, why did the elites in the army in Bolivia not do what elites and army in lots of poor countries have always done, which is, if you have to have an election, you fix them. And even if you have elections, especially when there's lots of unrest, armies often take over and just terrorize people. Or after the election, they sick the army on the mobilized people, kill a lot of them, and terrorize the rest. It seems that hasn't happened. It's just phenomenal that, quote, the international oil companies have to allow Evo Morales to become president. They must be wondering what's wrong with the CIA.
Well, it is phenomenal, but we also need to remember that, in part, Evo's success also grew out of years of social movements. There was the troops had been called out in 2003. The former president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, who was responsible for the privatization of the oil companies, was forced from office after calling out the army, and the army, you know, killed about 80 civilians. What happened instead is a 500,000 people start to march on the Capitol, and the army said, "Wait a second, you know, these are your policies, these are your problems." There are large forces in the army because it's not a homogeneous group. There are different interests within the army, so that there are a number of people in the army who do have this nationalist vision for Bolivian development, and also do see that their responsibility is to Bolivia as the Bolivian population. The elite is so small, and we want to think about Bolivia very much. We can compare it in certain ways to South Africa, where you have a very small population of European descent that really is ruling over a very large indigenous and mixed-race population. Only 5% of the people there are of European descent. So what we can think about is Evo's ascension to the presidency as the end of an Andean apartheid. He's the first indigenous president in Bolivian history, and he's the first president who really seems to have the interests of the majority of the population at heart. And in an area where you're where you can mobilize 500,000 people to take to the streets to demand social justice, it's really hard for the army to take a stand against.
Mm-hmm. Ben, one just a little. Could you talk right into your telephone now and then? Your voice fades. Not bad, but it's not a great transmitter. So talk right into it if you can. This is Bill Resnick again for the Old Mole, talking to Ben Cole, who with Linda Farthing wrote the book Impasse in Bolivia: Neoliberal Hegemony and Popular Resistance. You compared Bolivia to South Africa. I won't repeat why. A huge population of indigenous people being ruled by a fairly narrow elite of Europeans. South Africa has, since the African National Congress won elections, in fact, and took over and took considerable power in lots of ways. They, of course, have become split, and the international, quote, community, and South Africa is actually a big economic player with real resources and even banks, international banks headquartered there. But the, quote, international community has really come down hard on them in many, many ways and has, in fact, stymied any and stopped any real program of land distribution or crash program of investment in black housing and black villages and black infrastructure. Is that going to happen? And what do you see as the possibilities for Bolivia, particularly the oil monies, which could be used well or it could be immensely corrupting?
Uh-huh. Well, there are a couple of things. In the same way, it's important to notice that even though the identity politics that led Nelson Mandela to rule in South Africa, contributed to Evo Morales' victory in Bolivia, the fact is in South Africa they were still constricted by this straitjacket of global neoliberalism. Bolivia faces many of the same limits, and that's one of the things that we're really thinking about today. And I think that Evo's decision to increase the control of gas production and the revenues from gas production will give them a little bit of breathing room. But at the same time, he faces major challenges from the World Bank, from USAID, the European Union, the Spanish government, who wants to defend the interests of Repsol.
It's a Spanish oil company.
Spanish oil company. He has
the Brazilian government who wants to defend the interests of the Brazilian oil company, right?
And government, Lula has, in a recent meeting, Lula has stated that they will be somewhat more generous, and with Bolivia, they recognize the need to develop a more fair treaty with Bolivia and allow Bolivia to increase a greater share of the oil revenues. But we also need to remember that Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, is a mixed public-private firm with the state only controlling about 40% of the shares, and it's not clear that that the state will really be able to make Petrobras policy.
Mm-hmm.
Petrobras has said that they will they've put their future investments on hold in Bolivia. We'll see what that means over the long run. There are also a whole series of national actors that Bolivia needs to deal with, the local elites, as you were saying, the elites who in the past would have called out the armies, the elites in the past who do control much of the land resources. And one of the challenges that Evo faces is how he's going to be able to deal with these different forces, both within the government, because he is the president, while he does control the lower house of Congress, he does not control the Senate, he does not control the departmental governments, the equivalent of the state houses in the United States, so that his power is somewhat will be somewhat limited.
Yeah,
and
the power of his coalition. I'd rather not see it just as him, but of the whole, whatever it is, the whole uprising. It seems to me they also don't control control investment, either domestic investment or, as you point out in the book, in your book, or foreign investment, and it can all just dry up. It seems to me that what we see, let's say, in the West Bank right now, where they're just strangling the Hamas government. The whatever economy was left in the occupied territories, it seems to me that something similar, if lesser, I mean, oil is going to be pumped out no matter what, but they can sort of stop investing in modernization. They can let some of the refineries, if they're, you know, or the pipelines go. It seems to me, how do you keep in, how do you, and domestic elites in particular might decide to put their money into Chile or wherever they're going to put it, as they have, in fact. Now, as you point out in the book, some of the domestic elites take their money in, or foreign and invest in Chile, even if labor costs are higher in Chile, because they've got that stability, quote. How do you keep the investment going, and how do they build a sustainable economy, even with all that oil money coming in? And it's just also the question Venezuela faces.
Yeah, well, that's just the domestic elites have never really invested in a sustainable way in Bolivia. I mean, their investments have always required very high rates of return, and when they get a lot of money, they tend to favor to invest in Miami than in La Paz.
Miami is closer than Paris. They go to Paris, right,
or New York. But I think that Bolivia is in a much better position than the West Bank, in the sense that it does have access to the support of Chavez, who's offered to buy soy products. It does have very large markets for its natural gas in Brazil, in Argentina, an untapped market in Chile, which eventually I think will become the most important market for Bolivian gas. But still, Bolivia's economy is in a shambles. It was in a shambles before Evo took over, with per capita income of only about $1,000 per person per year. It would have to grow at a rate of China for a period of 15 years before the per capita income would be $4,000 per year. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly not going to be enough to turn Bolivia around over the short or medium term.
So, right. Ben Cole, we only have another minute left. Is there some way of summing up what would be the conditions that would make most possible the development of a sort of sustainable, healthy economy in Bolivia over that long run? And the conditions are national, but they're also international. Sorry to shorten it, but I know you only have another minute or so.
There are a couple of things that need to happen. Internationally, richer countries need to recognize the rights of poor countries to control their natural resources, and in the interest not just of some global stability, but also in terms of fundamental equity, need to recognize the role of poor countries, the needs of poor countries. At the national level, I think it's crucial that Bolivia continue investing in things like education, in national work programs, job creation programs, health care, because unless they can reconfigure or reconceptualize the economy in such a way so that it benefits the majority of Bolivians, the type of instability that we've seen in Bolivia will certainly continue in the future.
Mm-hmm. Ben Cole, thank you very much for talking to us.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. I'm Fran Michel. And later on the show, Bill Resnick will be back to talk with Linda Farthing about coca growing in Bolivia. And then I'm going to be talking with Jan Hocken, movie mole and movie maker, about Queens of Heart community therapists in drag. But first, it's time for the Well-Read Red. Bill Resnick and Ben Cole earlier noted the refusal of the Bolivian military to serve as the agents of neoliberal repression of their fellow Bolivians. But what about the U.S. military? What sort of resistance to business as usual can we find there? We know that a number of retired generals have lately spoken out against the war in Iraq, and a recent Zogby poll showed that 29% of U.S. troops in Iraq favor immediate withdrawal, while another survey shows 72% of them think the U.S. should withdraw within the year. Soldiers like Kevin Benderman, Carl Webb, Pablo Paredes, and Kelly Doherty have sought conscientious objector status. 400 have sought refuge in Canada, and some 9,000 have failed to report for duty since combat began in Iraq, while military recruiters have fallen notoriously short of their goals. In March, members of the group Iraq Veterans Against the War marked the third anniversary of the invasion by marching with Katrina survivors from Mobile, Alabama to New Orleans, Louisiana, calling on the government to abandon Iraq, not the Gulf Coast. Iraq Veterans Against the War, whose website is at www.ivaw.net, are also offering active duty soldiers free DVDs of the recent film Sir, No Sir, the suppressed story of the GI movement to end the war in Vietnam. Directed by David Zeiger, that film is playing through this Thursday at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Along with the book Soldiers in Revolt, GI Resistance During the Vietnam War, written by David Courtwright, and recently reissued with a new introduction by Howard Zinn, it provides an illuminating antidote to the right-wing's revisionist history of the 60s and 70s. One canard those works refute is the idea that the U.S. could have won the war if only cowardly Washington politicians had not tied the military's hands and prevented it from unleashing its awesome power against Vietnam. Courtwright argues that opposition to the war from within the rank and file forced the Pentagon to wind down the ground war. One problem was personnel shortages. By the Pentagon's own figures, well over 500,000 incidents of desertion occurred between 1966 and 1971. By 1971, entire units were refusing to go into battle in unprecedented numbers. 206,000 never reported for the draft. From 1970 to the end of 1972, shortly before the draft ended, 145,000 successfully applied for conscientious objector status. It wasn't just the enlisted ranks affected, either. College ROTC ranks, the main source of junior officers, dropped precipitously. Disciplinary problems further depleted the ranks. Administrative discharges for unfitness, unsuitability, or misconduct, including anti-war activity, grew steadily through 1971. After resistance of the soldiers on the ground led the Pentagon to shift to an air war, such discharges increased in the Air Force, peaking in 1973. Courtwright calls these extra-legal rebellions the GI resistance, which includes the instances of fragging, in which soldiers killed their commanding officers, often using fragmentation grenades, as well as cases of mutiny and sabotage. The GI resistance wasn't always overtly political or collectively planned, but it reinforced the efforts of what Courtwright calls the GI movement, referring to carefully planned opposition within the military and purposeful protest, actions that were designed often to exert pressure on politicians and the higher echelons of the military. GI signed petitions, placed advertisements in newspapers, formed picket lines, and marched at the head of peace demonstrations. They built organizations, created media, set up networks, and agitated. Another myth challenged by both Courtwright's book, Soldiers in Revolt, and Zeiger's film, Sir, No Sir, is that draftees led the GI opposition to the war. In fact, the greatest dissent came from those who had volunteered, the vast majority of whom were from working-class backgrounds. Many enlistees felt betrayed. One summed up the dynamic when he said, "Draftees get shit, aren't even disappointed. Volunteers expect something better, get the same shit, and have at least one more year to get mad about it." Soldiers in Revolt cites a number of studies that found the bulk of organized resistors in the military had volunteered. Dissent and sabotage also occurred in the Navy and Air Force, neither of which used conscripts. Finally, the rejection of, and more than occasional rebellion against, the war effort among combat soldiers who were overwhelmingly enlistees confirms Courtwright's assessment. On the other hand, as Rob Sout points out in a review of Soldiers in Revolt in Citizen Soldier, that's citizen-soldier.org, many enlistees volunteered so that they could avoid being drafted, and the presence of the draft heightened civilian opposition to the war. The same forces that affected the rest of society in America, the counterculture, the civil rights movement, the general loosening of authority, influenced servicemen. Black soldiers, who led much of the opposition, brought with them consciousness and political insights from the civil rights and black power movements. And far from spitting on returning vets, an urban legend that Sir, No Sir takes pains to debunk, civilian anti-war activists provided moral support, counseling, and other forms of legal and political aid. In an essay in the May 8th issue of The Nation magazine, Christian Parenti argues that military response to the Vietnam-era GI resistance has shaped the current armed forces. Ending the draft, he writes, excised much of the disgruntled element from the ranks, and by professionalizing the services, it has helped create a deepening military-civilian divide. Within today's all-volunteer military, there is much more intense solidarity than during the Vietnam era. After Vietnam, the military also improved its housing, wages, benefits, food, and training. It reached out to the families of soldiers and modernized its disciplinary systems and promotions methods, all of which improved morale. Another key difference between this war and Vietnam is the use of whole unit rotations as opposed to individual rotations. In Vietnam, a soldier was dropped into a unit for 365 days and then, if he survived, plucked out. In Iraq and Afghanistan, battalions of from 500 to 800 soldiers train together, deploy together, and come home together when they come home. During Vietnam, the constant flow of men in and out of line companies fighting the war seriously undermined unit cohesion and camaraderie. On the other hand, Parenti notes that activist vets all point out that unit cohesion can cut two ways. It works like kryptonite to stop rebellion, but after a tipping point, unit cohesion can serve to make rebellion even more intense. If 1960s activism was fueled by disillusioned outrage, Parenti suggests, then today's activism is fettered by a type of world-weary cynicism. Iraq veteran against the war, Fernando Braga, says most of the guys in his unit assume the war is based on lies and that it's all about oil, but that they won't get involved in peace activism because they say you can't change anything. But he points out, if you read history, you see that usually people have already changed things. Movements have made lots of things happen. The film Sir, No Sir, playing at the Hollywood Theater in Portland through this Thursday, helps reclaim the history of a movement that made things happen. For the Well-Read Red, this has been Fran Michel. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Fran Michel. And later on, I'll be talking with movie mole Jan Hocken about her documentary, Queens of Heart, Community Therapists in Drag. But next, we go to Bill Resnick talking with Linda Farthing about coca in Bolivia, how U.S. suppression is hurting the local growers, and why coca tea should be legalized.
Linda Farthing, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Linda Farthing, along with Ben Cole, wrote the book, a wonderful book, Impasse in Bolivia, Neoliberal Hegemony and Popular Resistance. It's done a lot of journalism and radio work. Linda Farthing, tell us about the coca economy and the U.S. in Bolivia.
Well, to start with, I think you need to start with coca as a plant, and to start with coca in its historical context. Coca is a really amazing leaf. I mean, it's come to prominence because of that. It has considerable amount of vitamins. It has been used in ritual use in the Andes for thousands of years. It cuts hunger. It helps people deal with high altitudes, of which there are quite a bit of high altitude places in the Andes. And it has been widely used in trade. So it has this historical use, and in fact, that historical use is still legal in Bolivia and in Peru, although it is illegal in Ecuador and Colombia, in the other two Andean countries that are historically the major producers of coca.
It's sort of like a tea, right, with nutritional capacity as well as a kind of painkiller and stimulant.
Exactly.
How does it taste, actually?
Well, I think that's the first thing that every tourist does when they get off the airplane or comes across the border is that they get a bag of coca and runs off to give it a try. I certainly did.
Oh, yes?
It has a bitter flavor, and not so much in the tea, but if you chew it, I mean, historically people chew it and they chew it with lime, which releases some of the alkaloids in it, which provide the stimulant in it. So if you chew it with lime, you do get your mouth will numb a little bit, and you get it's like a mild stimulant, something along the lines of a not very strong cup of coffee. I mean, that's the closest thing I can really compare.
How is it with sugar and condensed milk, that sort of English kind of tea? Do they do it that way, or is that...
No, people don't drink it. I couldn't imagine putting milk in coca tea. No, you don't. People do put sugar in it, though, quite a bit. Oh, love sugar. So quite a bit of sugar goes into it.
people have been drinking coca tea and chewing coca in the Andes forever, I gather. But since it's made in cocaine, the U.S. has decided to eradicate it. What has that done, in fact, in Bolivia?
Well, I think that you have to look at where the U.S. policy derives from, and I think like many other U.S. policies around it around the world, it's driven by the domestic agenda. And the domestic agenda is that governments in this country have to show that they're doing something about drugs, that drugs are a problem or perceived by a problem by the public, and therefore something has to be done. And the options that the U.S. have chosen, both in the United States and in countries like Bolivia, is a repressive model. It's a militarized model. So it's not based on seeing drug problems in this country, as many European countries do, as a public health problem, but rather on penalizing addicts and, in fact, not providing sufficient spaces for them and resources for them in order to help at least control their addiction, if not overcome it.
Although it's not really penalizing all addicts or users, it's penalizing the poor ones. The wealthy ones, of course, have.
Yes,
and they're sort of used as a scapegoat, and then they become a profit center for the prison industry.
Right, exactly. You're absolutely right. So the same model in some ways has been applied in South America, and here I'm talking a little bit more broadly than only Bolivia, which is a militarized repression model. The argument is that if you can cut back the supply of the coca leaf, which is the basic ingredient without which you can't make cocaine, that you can control the flow of cocaine to the United States. Well, this has been an absolute disaster, and it has fallen most heavily on the producers of coca themselves, who are for the most part impoverished peasants in the Andean region. And they have suffered 20 years of these policies of constant repression, and the net result has been that the amount of cocaine has not diminished. So when you do a heavy repression campaign in Peru, people grow more coca in Bolivia. When you do it in Bolivia, it shifts to Colombia. And this has not, as long as there is the high demand for cocaine, people are going to find a way to produce it.
Yeah, but it also, when you really get repressive about it, it means that sort of criminal gangs with guns are required to sort of protect it, sell it, all the rest of it. It seems to me once you criminalize the operation, then you run into even more problems, as, in fact, you do in the United States.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, there's no question about that. And so coca growers have suffered really at the hands of the U.S. policy. Now, to be fair here, the United States in the last 3 or 4 years has begun to change its policy. I mean, initially, it chose to view the coca growers as drug traffickers. And so it refused to work in any way, shape, or form with their representatives, which are the coca grower unions. And as a consequence, they attempted to set up parallel organizations in the communities, which were, of course, enormously divisive, because historically the coca grower unions, in an area where the government presence was almost non-existent, had filled the role of local government. And to set up parallel organizations or different organizations with the lure that you were going to get money for giving up coca in order to produce alternative crops, which certainly for a great deal of time there was no market for, and there's a great, wonderful, dramatic scene where coca growers were convinced to grow turmeric, which is not something that is widely used in cuisine in Bolivia, or export. And they had no market for it. So they ended up going to the fancy U.S. Agency for International Development agricultural station and throwing this yellow powder all over the place because they couldn't sell it, and they were so frustrated. And that sort of thing went on with a number of crops over a number of years. Now the USAID has started to somewhat change its focus and has started to express some willingness to work with the coca growers. A lot of this has come because of two things. One has been the coca growers now control municipalities in the Tapari region, which is the main coca-growing region in Bolivia, and the Europeans started working with them. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans, the EU, took the approach that what they needed to do was to strengthen government, local government organizations, and in order to create alternatives and not simply focus on coca per se, because the U.S. focus on coca meant if you forcibly eradicate coca, which they started to do in 1999, not only will production blossom in Colombia, but you leave people without anything to eat. And that means that they are going to become, as you suggested, more clandestine and move further away because they have no other choice.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Linda Farthing, who wrote with Ben Cole, wrote a book, Impasse in Bolivia, Neoliberal Hegemony, and Popular Resistance. We've been talking with Linda today about coca in Bolivia. Linda Farthing, we only have a couple more minutes. The coca growers, you pointed out, were in fact formed as sort of the de facto government in many of the areas where coca is grown in Bolivia. There was a relatively democratic government because these were small land holdings and it wasn't huge agribusiness. They were sort of cooperatives, too, in that they had to get the stuff out and work together with transportation systems. They set up educational systems. Is it possible to imagine a kind of democratic agricultural development in Bolivia based in coca and export of coca, which I understand is the Evo Morales plan, export of coca not as cocaine but as a tea, which could never be made into cocaine? What do you see as the prospects?
Well, Evo was the leader of the coca growers for many years. He came up out of the leadership of the coca growers. And, in fact, the unions were the local government. People migrated from the highlands, and they formed unions in order to manage their local communities. So you have, in essence, very democratic structures. I will note, very male-dominated democratic structures. I mean, the union member was the male head of the family, and that mm-hmm. still remains the case. But Evo's policy is the policy that they're trying to promote is the notion of no cocaine, but yes to coca, to try and absorb this production of coca through the legal export of tea. And in order to do that, they have to get coca decertified, I guess would be the word, from being an illegal substance under UN conventions, which were passed in 1961. The head of the vice ministry in charge of coca, who is in fact as well a former coca grower and was a mayor in the Tapari region, has just come back from a meeting in Vienna of the International Narcotics Control Board, rather discouraged by the prospects of this, because it's going to be a long, hard fight. There's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding. People equate coca with cocaine. Coca is not cocaine. It's sort of like saying that vodka is a potato or potatoes are vodka. In that sense, there are many processes it goes through to become cocaine. And in order to legalize the leaf, it's an uphill battle, and it is going to take some time to do it, and a lot of public education.
So I guess if we want to drink coca tea, we've got to go down to Bolivia. Right? But it's still, when you get off the plane in La Paz,
The first thing that people do is give you coca, either chew or take as tea, because it helps you deal with altitude, and you're at 13,000 feet.
And La Paz is a beautiful place, too, isn't it?
It's a wonderful city. Bolivia is a wonderful place.
Linda Farthing, thanks a lot for talking to us.
All right, you're welcome. Take care.
Right, you too.
You might need some shoes or a comfortable coat. You might need a sail for your little white boat. You might need a shirt or a colorful tam, a durable bag to bring home your ham. You can do it with industrial hemp. You can do it with industrial hemp.
The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and I'm here with Jan Hocken to talk about her documentary, Queens of Heart, Community Therapists in Drag. Jan, you work as a psychologist primarily. How did you end up making a movie? How did this project come about?
Well, it wasn't only me making a movie. Actually, my primary work, in addition to my work as a clinical psychologist, is working at the University of Portland State University as a community, a teacher, primarily in the area of gender studies, and a lot of my the focus of my teaching and research is on community psychology and the dynamics of social movements. And the film Queens of Heart, the documentary, came out of a film class I taught years ago on the feminism and the psychology of film. And a group of graduate students that included Heather Mosher, and we ended up working with Quamba Productions on this project, they produced a short on Darcelle and the club as a way of thinking about gender as a kind of performance, a theme we were taking up in the class. And in that same class years back, there was quite an interest in what's called audience response theory, reception theory, and although many people have speculated on how audiences make use of different sexual or different images of sexuality in the media and performances that draw out ambiguities around gender, we were interested in actually studying audience responses. So this actually extended into a community-based research project involving many students and activists in the community who were engaged in the question of how is drag subversive? Does it challenge people's notion of the stability of gender as a category and their notions about sexuality? Or does it simply reproduce conventional or reinforce conventional notions? So we, in a sense, through the group of students, took it up as an empirical question, began to be interested in how audiences were making use of the performance.
Yeah, some feminists in the past have sort of criticized drag and cross-dressing as a mockery of women or as attempting to appropriate femininity, though more recently the predominant feminist view has been that drag kind of effectively shows the way that gender is a social construct rather than a natural essence. So what does the film find? I mean, what sort of political reading of drag does the film end up presenting?
There are multiple interpretations of drag, particularly as it's moved from the margins and the role of drag in the late 60s as a part of the Stonewall Uprising could be read differently than the role of drag today as an entertainment center, primarily for straight audiences, as they come to kind of enjoy the temporary suspension of gender and sexual codes. And some would say, well, it gives relief from the strictures of gender, but does it really challenge people in a more basic way about their prejudices and about their assumptions? So we open up this question to multiple readings, and generally, we take the stance in this film that there's something much more important and engaged with audiences than initially, and there's something more complex going on at the club between audiences and performers than immediately meets the eye. Of course, that doesn't mean that everyone is changed and going, even any more than people are necessarily changed by seeing therapists. I mean, we sort of strain, there may be a strain in the parallel between casting them as therapists for the community and actual therapists. But there is something akin to a kind of therapeutic work we feel going on in the club in terms of challenging people's defenses, engaging people's anxieties, and helping them deal with those anxieties.
So hence the subtitle, Community Therapists in Drag. So the performers in that sense are doing a kind of political work, a kind of psychological political work. And actually in the film, they do it, I mean, they're shown in relation to various communities. The primary audience, the most sort of popular, I guess the staple of Darcelle's is straight audiences, often bridal parties, young women who are about to get married. But the film also shows Darcelle's interaction with and work with a variety of communities, including gay and lesbian communities. So, I mean, they're shown doing different kinds of political work in a variety of communities. What I'm wondering if you could talk about the kinds of political work that the film itself is intended to do. We've talked some on the Old Mole about what makes a film political and what kinds of political effects a film might have. What kinds of effects are you hoping this film will have? Who's the intended audience, and what sorts of effects are you hoping to have on that audience?
I think audiences now are people who have been conditioned by film culture, are savvy about the position of filmmakers in relation to their subject matter. They know that images are being constructed for them, and so this is not, I think, so new to audiences to have the film kind of bring into mind that the audience is participating in some way in the interpretation of what's going on. We do make use of that idea. And turning the cameras on to the audiences, and rather than posing the question, why do these men who have primarily developed this craft through gay culture, which has developed drag as a craft, as an entertainment form, people wonder, why do they do this? And instead we pose the question, why do audiences watch, and what are they getting from this? And it, I think, in a more sustained way, engages people in the question of what is the pleasure you're getting, and what anxieties and conflicts are you bringing to the queer community that's providing this for you? I mean, the drag performers are seen as inherently funny. Female impersonators are seen as inherently funny. But we brought the question over and over to audiences, well, what makes it funny and pleasurable? And who pays the price of the joke? What's the source of the laughter, the pleasure? And pleasure is tied to anxiety. Laughter is tied to anxiety. There's always a risk when you try to deconstruct humor that you kind of ruin the joke. And so we try to ride the crest of drag, the conventions of drag itself, and going from serious to whimsical, but it's really, I think, intended to have straight audiences think more carefully about the gift of queer culture to straight audiences and to the straight community, that drag performers are kind of hystericized, they're treated as fun but not terribly serious. These performers actually are incredibly thoughtful and insightful about what they do, and have sustained it for a very long period of time.
Yeah, something that I appreciate in the film very much is there's a lot of attention actually to the way that drag is work, and the labor that goes into it, and the fact that this, you know, this isn't just they're out there being themselves in some way, in some mysterious way.
Which is one interpretation audiences have, that they're just sort of expressing themselves.
Yes, this is just who they are.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. I mean, it's a very different kind of film than something like Paris is Burning, which is about drag balls in Harlem, where you don't get a sense of the filmmaker's involvement or the audience's involvement. So I guess for straight audiences watching this film, there's also they're sort of in a similar position to the straight audiences in the club watching the drag performance. So there's a kind of parallel that's operating there. Something else that's going on in the film, there are, I think, still there's a lot of references to psychoanalytic terminology. I mean, the subtitle is Community Therapists in Drag, and that, you know, they're presumed to have perhaps some kind of training in psychotherapy. I think some people who've seen earlier versions of the film have wondered about that choice. Can you talk about how you decided to do that and what function you see those kinds of terms as having in the film?
Initially, there's both a parody of psychoanalysis and taking it up seriously. I mean, I do come out of a psychoanalytic feminist background, and many film theorists make effective use of psychoanalysis as a way of addressing anxieties and the overinvestment in the phallus, and what is it that men are afraid of losing, and castration anxiety is a metaphor for kind of defensively also disavowing the anxiety around masculinity. It's not just phallus as a symbol of power, but that this tremendous anxiety in protecting something that is in part a fantasy. It's bigger than it seems. It's not as big as it seems to be, kind of idea. So we follow a tradition that has made use of psychoanalytic ideas in a subversive way in a left feminist tradition of taking up those ideas. And it's done in a bit of a tongue-in-cheek way here. We use terms like hysteria and castration anxiety that can be taken light, you know, it's like diagnosis light, but also can be seen like drag itself as engaging things that are quite serious at the same time. So there's both parody and quite serious at the same time.
The film is called Queens of Heart, Community Therapists in Drag, and it's going to be showing tomorrow night at the Hollywood Theater, which is 4122 Northeast Sandy. And I think the big Hollywood sign might be taken down, but you can still find it there, the Hollywood Theater. Tickets are $25. This is a fundraiser for completion films. I've seen an earlier version of the film, and it seemed done to me. I mean, what's left to do?
Well, I wanted to also mention that the Pride Foundation, Equity Foundation, as well as many other contributors from the community and volunteer labor have made this project possible at the ambitious level. We've pursued it. We want to submit it to international film festivals and really do the post-production work that'll polish it and really show this part of our history in Portland, and as well as draw out the themes of the film. So the it's a nonprofit project. So even though there are costs in finishing it, Equity also, the Equity Foundation will be the beneficiary of the final sale of the film. So we're hoping the community supports it as really a kind of Valentine from Portland too to the broader national and international audiences.
So don't miss Queens of Heart, Community Therapists in Drag at the Hollywood Theater tomorrow night. I've been talking with Jan Hocken. Thank you very much. And you've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thanks today to Bill Resnick, Ben Cole, Linda Farthing, and Jan Hocken. And thanks to our engineer, Tammy Dean. We'll be here again next week.
Tune to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. At 10:30, Earthwatch on Earthwatch, Dave Mazza introduces environmental journalist David Halvrag, and they talk about the state of the world's oceans. At 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, the guest is James Yee, a Muslim chaplain who was posted in Guantanamo Bay in 2002 and later was accused of espionage and locked up in a Navy prison. And right now, we're going to go to Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. You're tuned to the Radio Zine here at KBOO. Today, David speaks with Dr. William Kamen, author of Easy Labor, Every Woman's Guide to Choosing Less Pain and More Joy During Childbirth.